shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May, and summer's lease hath all too short a date. Sometime too hot the eye of heaven shines, and often is his gold complexion dimmed, and every fair from fair sometimes declines, by chance or nature's changing course untrimmed. But thy eternal summer shall not fade, nor lose possession of that fair thou owest, nor shall death brag thou wanderest in his shade, when in eternal lines to time thou growest. So long as men can breathe or eyes can see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee.
That's one of Shakespeare's famous love sonnets. The 14-line form of the sonnet has appealed to poets from the Renaissance to our own times. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
This spring, a group of English professors at the UW-Madison decided to illustrate the history of English literature by surveying six representative sonnets. In this hour, the first of two, Professor Michael Whitmore will take us into the Renaissance with a close reading of another Shakespeare sonnet. Professor Teresa Kelly will explore The Gypsy Camp by romantic poet John Clare. And Professor Caroline Levine will introduce the hour and later give us a reading of the first sonnet from Modern Love by Victorian poet George Meredith.
Welcome to University of the Air, one and all. Looking forward to delving into this, in a way, strange form. What's with this? 14 lines. Isn't that kind of arbitrary? What made somebody decide, and who invented the sonnet anyway, that 14 lines should be the number?
The term sonnet comes from the Italian word sonetto, which just means little sound. So it used to be just short poems. But the 14th century Italian poet Petrarch popularized the idea of a 14-line poem that was about love and particularly was a poem of desire to a beloved who remained out of reach.
That would be Laura?
Laura, exactly. And this form got imported into English poetry from the Petrarchan roots, and it took on kind of two most traditional forms. Now, poets, as you say, it's kind of an arbitrary form, and poets have been breaking the rules of the sonnet as well as using them for centuries. But it has kind of two traditional forms, the first one, the Petrarchan, and the other one, which gets called the Shakespearean sonnet, though Shakespeare didn't actually invent it. He just actually made it popular. So can I tell you a little bit about these two forms, just so that we have an idea in our heads how they work? They're two different rhyme schemes. So the Petrarchan sonnet, both of them have 14 lines. The Petrarchan sonnet has two groups of four rhyming lines. So they go the first and the fourth line and the second and the third line rhyme, A, B, B, A, and then C, D, D, C. So they have two groups of four and then two groups of three lines, E, F, G, E, F, G. And that form has been picked up by writers in English, even though that's the more Italian version of the sonnet. The Shakespearean version also has these groups of four, which we call quatrains, three of them, and then a couplet at the end, so a pair of rhyming lines. So it's interesting to think about why some poets choose one rather than the other. Keats said he hated the Shakespearean sonnet because it had this pouncing rhyme at the end.
Some people like couplets and some people don't.
Some people like couplets, exactly. But then it's also really interesting to think about how writers reject aspects of both of these traditions.
Especially when we get into the 20th century, as we'll do in the next hour.
What about the length of the lines, though? I mean, does it have to be that iambic pentameter, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, five of those first beat duos per line?
Conventionally, it is. It certainly doesn't have to be, as the poets will look at, show us.
Michael, when you read that famous, shall I compare thee to a summer's day Shakespeare sonnet, definitely that couplet at the end stood out, the so long as men can breathe or eyes can see, so long lives this and this gives life to thee, that famous couplet there.
Well, I think the couplets have a kind of ringing sound, and this is what happens with rhyming in poetry. The bells start to clang with each other, and depending on how fast and furious the rhymes come, you start to hear overtones and you start to get drawn in. But the two final rhymes in a Shakespearean sonnet are quite tight, and they tend to make a point.
And that's what he did in the plays, too, right? Though he tended to end, especially dramatic scenes, with a couplet.
That's right. When especially high social status characters will, after saying something wise or something really seductive.
Aphoristic, you might say.
Exactly. Or even proverbial. They will top it off with a nice rhyming couplet.
Now, you have another Shakespeare sonnet that you want to read and talk about, right?
Yes, I do. And I thought I would just begin by reading it. And then I will talk about it. This is Sonnet 113. Since I left you, mine eye is in my mind, and that which governs me to go about doth part his function and is partly blind, seems seeing, but effectually is out. For it no form delivers to the heart of bird or flower or shape which it doth latch. Of his quick objects hath the mind no part, nor his own vision holds what it doth catch. For if it see the rudest or gentlest sight, the most sweet favor or deformedest creature, the mountain or the sea, the day or the night, the crow or dove, it shapes them to your feature. Incapable of more, replete with you, my most true mind thus maketh mine untrue.
That seems like the optical version of my words fly up, my thoughts remain below, whereas without thought never to heaven go. You're seeing it or saying it, and yet there's a disconnect.
Yes, I think that this poem is very much about disconnection. And the reason why I chose it for two reasons. First, I think it shows someone who is standing outside of himself, or a speaker who is kind of taking a spectator position on what he or she is feeling. Most sonnets in this period are written and circulated by men. But in this case, the speaker, having seen his beloved, is now recognizing that his eyes deliver images to his mind, but the mind takes over and shapes everything that it sees to an image of the beloved. The fact that the speaker can recognize this shows us that this is a speaker who is capable of maybe in some way being skeptical of himself. And this is the first point I wanted to make about sonnets, is that sonnets show us speakers who have some distance on their own feelings, even though they feel them very powerfully. And I think skepticism is a part of it, actually. Shakespeare's sonnets say a lot about love and different kinds of love. But they also show us someone who is sometimes tentative or hesitant or even, you know, wondering whether this thing that he's experienced is authentic or real.
And tell us how he plays around with the idea of blindness in the poem.
Well, I think it's related to what he's saying about how the mind works and how the eyes work. So there is a pattern here between my eyes or my eye and mine. And when you put those two words together, which the printer for these sonnets did with an apostrophe, you get mine, which is a contracted form of my eyen, plural for eyes. So Shakespeare is thinking about the ways in which your eyes are yours, and they're supposed to deliver for you your one portal onto the world. But they're also deceiving. And
do you suppose the distanced nature of a sonnet has anything to do with the fact that it is such a precise discipline? It's not like lyric poetry where you're just going to let your heart flow. You know, you have to think in terms of these, whatever it is, 140 syllables.
Yes, right. Well, when I talk to my students, there's a very popular form of music that's come about in the last 5 years called emo, which is where you know, young music writers look down at their shoes and strum their guitars hard and pour out their hearts. That's not what a sonnet is. A sonnet is a very structured form of relating to yourself. I think of it more as a kind of, if you've ever seen gardens from this period, they're shaped in boxes. And a box garden is a compact little world that you're meant to walk through in some very precise ways.
We'll build sonnets in pretty rooms. Isn't that what John Donne said?
That's exactly right.
And what do you think is special about Shakespeare's use of the form?
I think Shakespeare is good at, I would say, two things. One, he is really good at connecting what is effectively an argument in the sonnet and one that's developing through the subsections in the rhymes to wordplay. This is someone who, for example, Samuel Taylor Coleridge called Shakespeare myriad-minded, which means a kind of multiplied ideas and thoughts by the thousands. So he's someone who proliferates images in his work, but he's also capable of clamping down and making them fit a structure. In this case, it's the formal structure of the Italian sonnet, which he's modified along with other Renaissance poets.
Is it true that Shakespeare would have in some ways valued the sonnets more than the plays because they were written down? He had to be, if anything, more careful with what went on the page?
Well, we know that Shakespeare took a more active role in publishing the sonnets than he did his plays. And I think his reputation as a member of court and someone seeking patronage would have been advanced more by publishing sonnets than it would have from publishing plays. The plays appear by interested parties who would like to make some money off putting them in print. But for plays, Shakespeare, as a member of a professional company, was interested in taking money at the door. For sonnets, he was interested in having his poems circulated in print and having his name circulated as well.
And since you have the audacity as a group to talk about this being the history of English literature as represented by a few sonnets, how would this sonnet suggest something about the Renaissance?
I think that this sonnet does something that I see frequently in the Renaissance. The Renaissance is interested in metamorphosis and transformations, and how emotions or the imagination takes something and turns it into something else. They got that idea from Ovid and the classical tradition, but it was something that I think meant more to them in a world that was changing so rapidly. You have exploration in the Atlantic and to the east. You have feudalism giving way to mercantilism. You have urbanization. This is really a world that's changing. And talking about how one thing becomes another becomes something very powerful, I think, for these people.
And how did Shakespeare make his sonnet somehow different than the Italian form, the Petrarch? The style, as Caroline was talking about, with using the 4-4-4-2 pattern rather than the 8-6. Mm-hmm. But how else is his work different?
Well, I think Shakespeare has some different concerns, and he also has a backlog of other sonnets behind him. So when Shakespeare is writing sonnets, there is a tradition of sonnet writing, not only on the continent, but in England. He has Wyatt, who's already done this. And so I think Shakespeare feels that it's a form to be juggled with and maybe to be played with. And that explicit sense that I am playing with this form, it is something that is established as part of the sonnet tradition in the Renaissance, and then it's one that continues, as we'll see, throughout the history of kind of writing this type of poetry.
Is it possible even to compare a Petrarchan love sonnet with a Shakespearean one in terms of how they handle romantic love differently in a sonnet?
I think, sure, yes, it is. However, let me add another difference. So there's the formal distinction between how the rhyme schemes work. Petrarch is writing about Laura and his feelings of the feeling that he loves her, but she is untouchable. There's something almost cruel about her indifference. Shakespeare writes about a beloved who's a woman, the so-called dark lady, who has dark eyes.
Hair like dark wires.
Exactly. But a substantial number of these sonnets are written to a handsome youth. So Shakespeare is exploring a number of different kinds of love and desire. They could be friendship, sexual love, which could be homoerotic love. It could be adulterous love. I think he has a broader palette of – I think it's wrong to put Petrarch in the kind of he's being left behind column, because Petrarch is tremendously inventive and wide-ranging himself. But what I notice about Shakespeare is that he combines this range of feelings and different types of romantic attachment with a kind of studied distance from his own feelings that can become actually really almost philosophical.
Why don't you read the sonnet one more time then? Because I think one of the nice things about a sonnet form is it's short enough to hear it several times and to kind of feel you You have it. You own it.
Yes, I think that's a good idea. Since I left you, mine eye is in my mind, and that which governs me to go about doth part his function and is partly blind, seems seeing, but effectually is out. For it no form delivers to the heart of bird or flower or shape which it doth latch. Of his quick objects hath the mind no part, nor his own vision holds what it doth catch. For if it see the rudest or gentlest sight, the most sweet favor or deformedest creature, the mountain or the sea, the day or the night, the crow or dove, it shapes them to your feature, incapable of more, replete with you. My most true mind thus maketh mine untrue.
Question about persona, point of view. Is this necessarily Shakespeare speaking? After all, this is somebody who created hundreds of very well-rounded characters.
I think that's a great question. When we try to teach the sonnet and other lyric forms in our classes, we make a point of distinguishing between the persona of the speaker and the historical person who wrote the poem. It's possible to confuse them in Shakespeare's case because there seem to be overlaps between what this speaker feels and the person we know historically to be Shakespeare. But I think he takes the opportunity to ask, let's think as if I were this person in this scenario, and then to write about it. And that's part of the way he thinks about playwriting as well. In fact, you have to be able to do that, to take yourself out of your own experience and say, well, what about this scenario?
You know, what if I were Iago, say?
Exactly.
How would I think?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And he's always aware in these sonnets, it seems to me, of the fact that they're going to last. As in the first sonnet you read, where he says, this sonnet gives life to thee, that mm-hmm. the beloved lives through the words.
That's right. And it's a bittersweet idea. The beloved is going to age, and so will the speaker. So the poem is offered as a kind of consolation. You will die, I will die, people will read this.
That seems to be a popular Renaissance idea, too. I think you find that sure. in some of the poetry of John Donne, yeah. for example.
Yeah, I think Renaissance poets were concerned about legacies. And one reason why was because they themselves were perpetuating a legacy that they self-consciously revived from antiquity, from Greek and Roman culture. In doing so, they said some nasty things about the Middle Ages, which they called sometimes the Dark Ages. But really, that was an exercise in positioning themselves and authorizing themselves to be the kinds of poets and writers they wanted to be. So maybe writers like Donne or Shakespeare were thinking about creating monuments.
Are they thinking at this point primarily as the sonnet as a love poem? And is that true even of the Petrarchan tradition?
Well, love is the theme and the speaker is a persona. So there's that level.
They're not writing about, oh, gosh, you know, the mountains and the birds are so beautiful, the kind of thing you would find in the
sure.
Romantic era.
Sure. But different writers use this form and even its themes for different purposes. In Shakespeare's case, he might use it to think about longevity or even his own mortality or his reputation as a writer. You know, there's something kind of self-interested about Sonnet 18 that we began with. Other writers may be thinking about politics, about what it's like to live in a world that no longer makes sense. The sonnet is a very flexible thing, but it also imposes certain demands on writers. So I think you find that some writers are willing to accept those and reproduce them, but others want to find ways of taking an off-ramp.
Now we're going to jump from the Renaissance to the Romantic period when we're back in a moment with the University of the Air.
The Gypsy Camp. The snow falls deep. The forest lies alone. The boy goes hasty for his load of brakes, then thinks upon the fire and hurries back. The gypsy knocks his hands and tucks them up and seeks his squalid camp half hid in snow beneath the oak, which breaks away the wind
and bushes close, which with snow like hovel warm. There stinking mutton roasts upon the coals, and the half-roasted dog squats close and rubs, then feels the heat too strong and goes aloof. He watches well, but none a bit can spare, and vainly waits the morsel thrown away. 'Tis thus they live, a picture to the place, a quiet, pilfering, unprotected race.
That's the sonnet, The Gypsy Camp, by John Clare. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. And our guests from the English department in this two-part history of English literature through the sonnet form, our guests are Teresa Kelly, who just read that sonnet, Michael Whitmore, and Caroline Levine. Terry, in this sonnet from the Romantic period, tell us, first of all, how we jumped from the Renaissance with Shakespeare all the way into the early 19th century with John Clare. We sort of skipped a whole century.
We did. Prior to that century, Milton wrote sonnets. Not a great many, but they had an enormous impact on Romantics, who essentially took up the sonnet form after about a century of occasional sonnets, most of them not very good, and many of them not memorable. And so at that point, right at the end of the 18th century, Charlotte Smith begins writing sonnets and makes the sonnet, again, a poetic space where all sorts of experiments begin to occur. And all of the Romantic poets who follow Smith take up the sonnet, with the possible exception of Byron.
It was a little too constrained for Byron,
perhaps
I suspect,
so.
Although it would be delightful to see what he would have done with it. This is a spectacular poem by John Clare. This is not a love poem. This is not a Renaissance poem by any stretch of the imagination. It reads like a little scene from a novel.
And indeed, one of the things about it that is intriguing to me is that the speaker takes a long time in the poem to convey any particular attitude. It seems much more repertorial, descriptive at the beginning. And it's only really
squalid. That would be the first clue,
yeah.
I think.
And that attitude would seem to be, in fact, a kind of determined distance on the gypsy camp, a kind of unwillingness to think inside the category of being a gypsy, living in a camp in the winter in the snow, until the very end when we get that very odd sequence of adjectives, quiet, pilfering, unprotected. And at that point in the poem, one begins, I think, to sense that the speaker does have an attitude that's not wholly distant from the gypsies. And it suggests, too, something on along the lines that Michael was suggesting to us earlier, and that is that the speaker of this sonnet seems, in fact, to take a position that seems to insist not on love, but on reporting. And then gradually that position begins to offer itself as perhaps more closely attentive to those gypsies than you might have thought.
Yeah, it's almost, at least the way I took it in your reading, Teresa, was that at first, from a distance, oh, how picturesque, you know, a gypsy camp. And then we get closer and get into the reality of it. Mm-hmm. And you get the squatting, half-roasted dog, mm-hmm. you know, waiting for the little morsel, and it's not being forthcoming. And this is not picturesque. This is not romantic by any stretch.
Indeed. And when the speaker says almost at the end, a picture to the place, I think it's a way to just say right back to the picturesque, this is not a little nugget of a scene that you see in the distance of a painting or an image. This is something that I'm bringing up much closer to you, almost little things like noticing where that squalid camp is and how it's protected barely beneath the oak, which breaks away the wind, the bushes that are close around it, and its snow-like hovel still slightly warm because of the protecting aspects of it, suggests suddenly that the speaker is paying a lot of attention to figures that would normally be dismissed in the picturesque, you know, thought of as sort of a little tiny piece of local color that you didn't have to pay attention
to. He's throwing in all the senses, too, you know. He's got the sense of touch with that half-roasted dog, you know, trying to get warm by the fire. And so you have the sense, of course, of heat and cold and the stinking, you know, meat. Which really jumps right out at you. And then, of course, the visual, too. And you suspect that if you could taste that meat, it would live up to your expectations.
Right. You know that that meat is not something that you would normally want to eat. You would only eat it if you were desperate for food. And that, too, suggests very, very indirectly just how desperate the gypsies are for any kind of nourishment.
I think John Clare is not as well-known a figure as Keats and Wordsworth and Blake and so on. Tell us a little bit about him and how this sonnet would have fit his worldview and his other works.
Clare was, in fact, a worker poet. He was poor. He was an agricultural laborer that made whatever kind of living he could, working for whomever he needed to work, tended to work on a temporary basis. And this was not unusual for people of his class at this time. He read a great deal of poetry nonetheless, but it wasn't easy for him to get to reading. He had to find places, find time, find occasions. He also found friends who lent him poems and lent him books and published his early poetry before he was noticed by a London publisher. But he was very, very poor. He was also very slight and suffered physically and finally mentally from the difficulties of his life, his existence. He makes a lot of what happened to people like him with the enclosure of formerly public lands that made it difficult to do small kinds of things that would allow you money in a market, like picking up bits of wool and carting them from sheep that had grazed on public lands. That sort of thing was no longer possible. It wasn't possible to snitch little bits of a harvest any longer. So it was a much more difficult life for the occasional agricultural laborer than it had been before enclosure. And that enclosure hits the community where Clare lives at about the time that he becomes a young man and changes his life.
I would venture to say that if Charles Dickens wrote sonnets, they would come out about like this. I mean, this is so different from what had been, you know, written by Wordsworth and Coleridge, who were, of course, were politically conscious and certainly wrote about some of the same issues that you have mentioned, but not this pointedly.
No, not this pointedly, and indeed not this irregularly, if I can put it that way. The only two lines that rhyme in this poem are the last two, which act like a Shakespearean couplet rhyme at the end of a Shakespearean couplet in that they send you back through the rest of the poem, asking you to kind of rethink, I think, the speaker's stance toward what he seems to be describing in a very distant way at the beginning, but which he seems to, in the course of the poem, have recognized at a somewhat closer range, which you don't get from this poem. That is clear to anybody who's read a lot of Clare's poems, is that he had a very close affiliation with gypsies. He understood their condition as being something like his own. And yet he chooses in this poem to stand back initially. So it's a very conscious choice of persona, which is fascinating to see.
They're grimy, kind of repulsive, and yet unprotected. And that, as you mentioned earlier, that procession of adjectives is like coming from three different directions. Well, quiet, you can take any number of ways, but pilfering is unequivocal.
Yes, and gypsies, in fact, were illegal in England at this time, and largely widely charged with being pilferers and being difficult elements. In fact, a gypsy roaming England in Clare's time would be subject to capital punishment if caught. So there truly are outlaw figures.
Truly unprotected.
And truly unprotected, legally, absolutely unprotected.
It seems to me a romantic subject, but being approached in an almost unromantic way. In other words, it's romantic to have gypsies, to have the woods, to have the quiet snow, to have a boy. All that seems very romantic,
absolutely.
But we don't get a sentimental picture here.
No, there's nothing sentimental about this. And in fact, it's a poem that makes you wonder both how sentimental some of the most interesting romantic poetry really is. And it's a poem which reminds me of other Clare poems where sentiment is not the long suit, where there's a much clearer tendency to stop, notice, look, and then move on. This poem, if anything, is among the more sympathetic to its subject than some of other of Clare's poems, which are perhaps implicitly sympathetic in that he takes things like a mouse's nest or a bird's nest and pays attention to them.
Like our friend Robert Burns.
That's right. That's right.
Who also came from that sort of hardworking tradition.
That's right, and whom Clare was quite willing to imitate, to ventriloquize.
To pilfer.
Yes, to pilfer.
I guess it almost raises the question, too, of what does it have to be a sonnet? Because if nothing rhymes except that final couplet, and if it's not about love, then is any 14-line poem a sonnet?
It raises a very good question. You're right. I think in this case, it's not about love, but it's about a kind of focused regard, which gets closer in focus, tighter in focus as the poem continues. And that, it strikes me, is an element of the sonnet tradition that romantics rework. Not all romantic sonnets are about love.
Well, again, I mean, even some of Shakespeare's sonnets, the one about one of the Dark Lady sonnets, he's saying, well, okay, if, you know, blonde hair is what, gold wires, then my love has black wires. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, mm-hmm. she may not be, you know, the most fantastic girl to look at in an ideal sense, but she's mine. And same thing here. They're not attractive. Mm-mm. And yet they are worthy of your attention and perhaps even your protection.
Yeah. And I would say, too, that Clare is himself, although he wrote hundreds of sonnets, resistant to the tradition. And one of the ways that he practices that resistance is to refuse in almost all of them to adopt a sonnet rhyme scheme of any recognizable kind for any length of time. He may do an alternate rhyme. He may do this couplet rhyme. But he refuses the sense of shaping and enclosure, if you will, of that traditional form. And yet he writes sonnets again and again with some of the same intensity of attention that we associate with the tradition.
Was he appreciated in his day?
He was, after London publishers began to publish some of his work, for a short period. He was renowned, but also renowned, he was very carefully packaged as a peasant poet, and packaged to whatever extent the publishers could, as a polite peasant poet. So there were lots of discussions about which poems were appropriate and what uses of language would be permitted or not. And for a time, Clare permitted this kind of monkeying with his language. And then he became, again, quite resistant and came to understand critiques of his grammar, his syntax, his use of ugly words like stinking mutton as being unpoetic. He began to resist those.
Of course, Jonathan Swift liked that word, too.
It's true.
It almost reminds me his sort of the peasant poet of later on with Robert Frost posing as a kind of gentleman farmer poet, writing sonnets as well. Can you read it again?
I'd be happy to.
And what is the date of this sonnet?
The date of this sonnet is about 1841. Yeah, we think it was written about 1840, and it was published in a magazine in 1841.
So sort of as the Romantic period is waning and
That's
moving
right.
into the Victorian period.
That's right. And as Clare himself is in his, that would make him in his early 60s. The snow falls deep. The forest lies alone. The boy goes hasty for his load of brakes, then thinks upon the fire and hurries back. The gypsy knocks his hands and tucks them up and seeks his squalid camp half hid in snow beneath the oak which breaks away the wind and bushes close with snow-like hovel warm. There stinking mutton roasts upon the coals and the half-roasted dog squats close and rubs, then feels the heat too strong and goes aloof. He watches well, but none a bit can spare. And vainly waits the morsel thrown away. 'Tis thus they live, a picture to the place, a quiet, pilfering, unprotected race.
We're going to follow the sonnet into the Victorian era when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Modern Love. By this he knew she wept with waking eyes, that at his hand's light quiver by her head, the strange low sobs that shook their common bed were called into her with a sharp surprise and strangled mute like little gaping snakes, dreadfully venomous to him. She lay stone still, and the long darkness flowed away with muffled pulses. Then, as midnight makes her giant heart of memory and tears drink the pale drug of silence, and so beat sleep's heavy measure, they from head to feet were moveless, looking through their dead black years by vain regret scrawled over the blank wall. Like sculptured effigies, they might be seen upon their marriage tomb, the sword between, each wishing for the sword that severs all.
A poem by Victorian, and one hesitates even to use a term that's almost too broad to be meaningful, Victorian poet George Meredith, as part of our survey of English literature through the sonnet, that very singular form. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach. Our guests for this hour are Michael Whitmore, Teresa Kelly, and Caroline Levine, who read that poem by George Meredith. It's sonnet number one from a collection called Modern Love, and it does certainly seem modern, doesn't it? We are a long way removed now from those idealized women in sonnets.
Yes, well, Meredith is so clearly trying to remind us of the love tradition in the sonnet and also to leave it behind and look at this devastating, scorching portrait of a marriage in ruins. And he writes 50 sonnets, the sonnet sequence called Modern Love, and I just read the first one. But you can see from the very beginning, this couple is tormented by hatred and all kinds of antagonisms and desire as well, and the kind of frustration of trying to connect. So it still has the distance of the love poem from Petrarch with the distant beloved, but instead of that distance being crossed by desire, it's crossed by the impossibility of actually joining.
He does a difficult but effective thing here, using those run-on lines, which are harder, I would say, than doing a, you know, straight line against line match. But what the effect is of, it's almost conversational.
Yes. You know, it was something that got Meredith into a lot of trouble when he wrote these sonnets, but which in recent years people have actually appreciated about him, which is that he was also a novelist. And so his sonnet sequence borrows quite a lot from the novel, including a kind of conversational tone and these long sentences that don't stop at the line breaks. So the first six lines is all one sentence. And that's kind of typical of his way of – and then he also writes 50 sonnets where there's an actual story, a whole – there's adultery, there's suicide, there's all kinds of things. And so he weaves them together like a novel. And some of his early reviewers said, this isn't poetry at all. This belongs in prose.
It's kind of interesting the way – in his novel, The Egoist, he talks about selfishness and the difficulty of getting outside yourself. In this poem, that line, the strange low sobs that shook their common bed, they have a common bed, but something is dividing them apart in that image at the end where there's a sword between them.
Is this a plea for divorce? When he says each wishing for the sword that severs all.
There is, I think, an impulse. This poem was written in 1862, and there is an impulse in this moment for more liberal divorce laws. And Meredith's own wife had run off with another artist. So people have read this poem as autobiographical. But one of the things I love about this poem is that they have a common bed, and Meredith wants us to see them sharing something, but what they share is separation. And so the image of this kind of medieval form of the marriage tomb where you have two people side by side with a sword between them, that's this kind of old form brought in to renew another old form, the sonnet, but in such an excruciating way that just makes separation the only possible. So the marriage tomb becomes the image of modern love.
Can you say something about the style, the form of the sonnet that Meredith uses here and how he uses rhyme, structure, the two different sonnet traditions?
Well, you know, one of the things about these sonnets that has always puzzled me is why they're called sonnets. Meredith called them sonnets, and all of his reviewers called them sonnets, but they're 16 lines instead of 14 lines. So you would think that the one quality of the sonnet that's consistent is the 14 lines. But he adds two lines, and he explicitly calls them sonnets so that people have to think about the sonnet tradition. And there's that same sense, as Norman was saying a couple minutes ago about these long sentences, there's a sense of expansion, as though modern love needs more space than old love, and that you can't fix it in 14 lines. And I think he's also playing, so the conventional Petrarchan sonnet, which has eight lines and then six, often has a kind of turn. It's called the volta, which means turn in Italian, from the first eight to the last six. So it might be a question and an answer, or it might be an image of the beloved that turns back to the lover. And Meredith, instead of having it unevenly, eight and six, has two eights And it's like the husband and the wife, and he gives kind of equal time to the husband's and the wife's psychology. And it's as though he needs two quatrains each and not eight and six. He doesn't want any unevenness. You can actually see in the sonnet I read that there isn't a victim here. So her sobs are like snakes that are venomous to him. But then in the next line, Meredith says, she lay stone still. So it's as if she's also a victim of these snakes. She's been turned into stone by the
Medusa.
It's
a no-fault situation.
So there's a no-fault situation, exactly. And he's very careful and very interested in the psychology of both parties, both the man and the woman in this terrible story.
The psychology was quite a fascinating topic for the Victorians, wasn't it? I mean, I think, of course, of the Brownings. Robert Browning just loved these psychological poems, these moments of self-revelation.
Yes, and I think Meredith is really superb at capturing what somebody like Freud would see as meaningful, these tiny fleeting gestures that you don't even think about, like the hand's light quiver of the husband by the head of the wife, and that those are intensely meaningful in Meredith. And so he compresses – part of the thing that I think he likes about the sonnet is that it is this very compressed, condensed form, and he kind of has it both ways by writing 50 of them. He gets both the expansion and the condensation. And so these minute, intensely felt moments are themselves so meaningful, and that's sort of a something that 20th century psychology and psychoanalysis will pick up on. And something that I think is sometimes little known is that Freud was a big reader of 19th century novels. So I can imagine him actually really enjoying reading Meredith.
And we'll stay away from symbolism then.
Yes, yes. I don't think you actually need to say much about symbolism because it's so literal in Meredith. I mean, so much of what is
happening is
explicit, exactly. And that really shocked initial reviewers who said, one of them said, this poem should really be called Modern Lust. It's not bad
at all. I was thinking of the George Sand novel that ends, they married and lived unhappily ever after.
Yes.
And also if you think of George Eliot's Middlemarch from the Victorian period where you have the heroine married but realizing that it's an enclosed basin, not an open sea, that her marriage is a lifeless trap. There's a lot of images here of death within this marriage.
Back to the marriage tomb idea.
It's kind of my life goal to unsettle this idea of the Victorians and particularly Victorian poets as sentimental and conventional and smug. And I think Meredith is maybe the best example of this. How close can you bring love to death is really in part his central question. How can you still think in terms of love and yet also think about devastating anguish so intense that it's actually going to produce a suicide in this poem? And so there is, as with Claire, nothing sentimental about the sonnet.
If you wanted to be a little bit crass about it, you could take this as a sequel to that Keats poem, The Eve of St. Agnes, which also has a lot of this sepulchral imagery at the beginning when this couple runs away into the night and you think, oh, how romantic, and yet it remains cold and frozen.
Yes, the ways in which so many poets in the 19th century are looking backwards in order to write a poetry that captures something about their own moment is just totally fascinating. And they look back to the Renaissance and they look back to the medieval period. And you can see Meredith here doing both because he looks back to the Renaissance to borrow the sonnet. Then he transforms it. And he looks back to the medieval image of the tomb monument. And so he's really wanting to write about something quintessentially modern, this failed marriage. And he has all these kind of modern scenes that people objected to, like a dinner party in the sonnet sequence and arguments between husband and wife that
things
just didn't seem to fit.
Didn't seem lofty enough.
Lofty enough, exactly, for poetry.
Too prosaic.
But he still has to look backward. It's as though to be modern, you always have to think about your relationship to the past. You can't just break from it. You have to think about how you're breaking from it. And he's so clearly looking backward in order to look forward.
That's actually another distinction about the sonnet and maybe even poetry in general that we didn't touch on, and that is the tone. I remember Coleridge in Biographia Literaria saying, here is two lines of poetry. Why is this not poetry? Put my hat upon my head and walked along the strand, and there I met another man whose hat was in his hand. Why is that not poetry? It rhymes, you know, it scans and all that. Because the idea is not elevated enough. And that would be one of the things that you would expect in a sonnet would be something fairly elevated. But could you write something even more prosaic than this and have it be still a sonnet?
Oh, sure. And one of the things that happens in the Victorian period is that poetry stops feeling like the central literary form as it had during the Romantic period, where not only was poetry very dignified and widely respected, but it also was popular and people used to buy it in huge numbers. By the 1840s and 50s, it's really sunk in its both cultural value and its popularity. And so a bunch of poets start to experiment with bringing poetry closer to the novel. And that prosaic, so Elizabeth Barrett Browning does this in Aurora Leigh, and she got into tremendous trouble also. And there's a sense that there's a violation of what's basic to poetry in that. But you can also see how it's tremendously fertile for the 150 years to follow, because poets will continue to say, we need to think about the ugliness of life, we need to think about the terrors of our times, we need to think about violence and danger. And we need to think about ordinariness, humdrum life. And if we don't have poetry, then we lose some way of organizing our thoughts in a way that allows us to think about really the tiniest nuances of language so that we can think really precisely about our own experience.
So the Romantics did some of that, too. I mean, you go back to, you know, I walk through every chartered street down where the chartered Thames doth flow, and, you know, Milton, thou shouldst be living in this hour. We're really screwed up here in London. You know?
Yeah, I think Wordsworth is, though he's famous as a nature poet and Dancing with the Daffodils, he's really, really interested in trying to write a poetry that will do justice to some of the pain and ugliness of modern life also. And so Steamboats, Viaducts, and Railways is a sonnet by Wordsworth, which so deliberately rejects love as a theme, right? Or you could say, I would kind of thinking about what Mike and Terry have said about their sonnets, I want to say, you know, maybe love is just a huge philosophical topic. And there are a lot of ways to love, and there are a lot of things to love. And so maybe you can love Steamboats, Viaducts, and Railways. You can love the gypsies. You can love the process of being skeptical about yourself. And so the sonnet always raises that question, what could love be, or what could our position on the world be that would still be encompassed by this tradition of thinking about love?
Do you think that with George Meredith choosing in this poem not to end with a couplet, that it's also suggesting as we get into the Victorian era and after Darwin and all the rest of it, that you can't wrap things up with a tidy moral, that it's not quite as clear a conclusion anymore.
Nor can you end with a couple, because the couple has been destroyed. But actually, it's Modern Love as a sonnet sequence has a number of references to evolutionary theory and to he works a lot with the idea that because nature doesn't give meaning, because nature is just a bunch of contingencies and accidents, human life is also struggling for meaning. And so he weaves together a kind of interest in the natural world where people have lost faith in the idea that it's coherent and that there's a divine presence that's taking care of all natural creatures, and thinking about marriage in light of a natural world.
Not necessarily made in heaven.
Exactly.
Let's hear that one again.
By this he knew she wept with waking eyes, that at his hand's light quiver by her head, the strange low sobs that shook their common bed were called into her with a sharp surprise and strangled mute like little gaping snakes, dreadfully venomous to him. She lay stone still, and the long darkness flowed away with muffled pulses. Then, as midnight makes her giant heart of memory and tears drink the pale drug of silence, and so beat sleep's heavy measure, they from head to feet were moveless, looking through their dead black years, by vain regret scrawled over the blank wall. Like sculptured effigies, they might be seen upon their marriage tomb, the sword between, each wishing for the sword that severs all.
I was thinking of the difference between hearing that and then also being able to see it on the page. And I know we've put a link on our website to your webpage about these sonnets that includes all the printed versions of the sonnets that we've been hearing. Because the sonnets, when we're looking at them, we can see the rhymes. You know, we can see that pattern a lot more easily than when we're just listening to it.
On the other hand, how much are you meant to see it and how much are you meant to just hear it?
I think with Meredith, you're expected to look. He is, as Emily says, he's actually rhyming. These are four quatrains that rhyme. But because he breaks his lines not where the sentences break, you can't hear the rhyme when you just read it aloud. And so having the combination of seeing the rhyme but not hearing it kind of is disorienting and interesting. And it's that tension between the novel on the one hand and the smooth sentence that gets you somewhere and the sonnet on the other hand with its tight organization.
But you get this kind of resonance in his approach as opposed to the danger of the sing-song effect that you would get if everything, again, were sort of like seven couplets, or in his case, eight, all the way down.
Yes, that's right. He's resisting. So he's both using the artifice of rhyme and resisting being bound into something that sounds too artificial. And I think you could think about marriage that way too, right? What brings people together? Well, this form of the legal union. But does it actually bring people together? Similarly, does the sonnet really bring ideas together or not? And he's kind of experimenting with this sense of what form is and what is its relationship to content.
Anything egotistical about having this 16-line, 14-line?
Yeah, I'm bigger than all the poets who've gone before me. He's certainly not famous for his modesty.
For what it's worth, 16 seems to me about as far as you could stretch it and still think of it in that kind of pithy, bite-sized piece of poetry.
I think you're right. I think he was pushing at the boundaries of what we'd accept as the sonnet, and it was only by continually insisting this is a sonnet that people agreed to call it that. And I think if he went any further, people would say, no, enough already.
Not enough for this hour, but unfortunately the time is elapsed. We could go on for quite a while investigating these charming corners of English literature.
And we are going to go into a second hour looking at 20th century uses of the sonnet. Our guests this hour have been Michael Whitmore, Teresa Kelly, and Caroline Levine. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland. Hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.
With us next Sunday afternoon at 4 for University of the Air as we look at three more sonnets. One so recent that its author will be with us. That's University of the Air next Sunday afternoon at 4. Join us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.